From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Arturo Sarocan was Mexico's ambassador to the United States from 2007 to 2013. Over the years, he says both countries' governments have done a poor job explaining to their citizens why the U.S.-Mexico relationship is important to them.
But on a day-to-day basis, no country touches the lives of American Americans as Mexico does and vice versa.
I'll talk with Ambassador Sarocan on today's show. But first, Rebecca Cruz and I will discuss this week's decisions at the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia in The Hague.
This really kind of carries this full circle for many of the people in Bosnia, though leaving many questions, of course.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelott. Rebecca Cruz, let's talk about one of our favorite parts of the world, but a sad story, actually, an update on the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia regarding the war crimes and the decisions that were made this week. Bosnian Serb army leader Ratko Mladic was his sentence was upheld, life sentence upheld. And then Slobodan Paljak, a Bosnian Croatian general, had his 20-year sentence upheld, and there was lots of high drama. Let's get to what happened this week in The Hague, but let's talk a little bit about the ICTY and what happened with the Mladic case.
Yeah, it's a very interesting case. As you know, the ICTY has existed for almost 25 years now, set up a really unique institution set up by the UN in 1993 while the war in Bosnia was ongoing. But really one of the first of its kind. It was soon followed by the similar tribunal for Rwanda, specifically to deal with war crimes from outlined in the Geneva Convention, genocide, crimes against humanity, that sort of thing. So almost 25 years, it was slated to close in 2010. But there were actually still some people on the loose, and one of those was Mladic. He wasn't actually captured until 2011, so he was on the run, if you will, although in plain sight by many indications, until 2011. His trial then has gone on for quite some time. We're obviously now in 2017, so this was a very long process. He has been nicknamed the Butcher of Bosnia. He is the general that has now been convicted of carrying out the massacres at Srebrenica. He had 9 counts against him of crimes against humanity, and then 2 specifically of genocide. And we've talked about this before in the show, how difficult it can be to legally prove genocide. One of those counts was upheld and one was not. So that creates some interesting ideas on justice for those that were part of Srebrenica, the one that was upheld, and then a neighboring area, the one that was not upheld. So there are some family members there that are obviously quite upset. But this and then the other case that you mentioned really kind of carries this full circle for many of the people in Bosnia, though leaving many questions, of course.
Well, as you mentioned, the one case of genocide that was not upheld, the reaction, of course, in that area, the Visegrad area, was quite negative. They felt that justice had not been served. Interestingly, though, the Serbian president, after the ruling this week, just kept telling his people in Serbia, we need to look for the future. We need to look toward the future. There was really no even recognition that this was just, that this was deserved. He basically said this was expected, that we knew that he would be convicted, but now we need to look forward. And in some ways, yeah, we need to look forward, but there's a reconciliation process here that is still perhaps underway in this part of the world.
That's going to obviously take generations. But let's remember that Mladic, of course, he was an ethnic Serbian in Bosnia, but it was in Serbia that he was captured many years later. So many people knew that he was there. It was him and 3 others that were on the most wanted list for quite some time. And it really wasn't until Serbia was looking towards international organization membership, the EU and NATO from time to time, that we start seeing these arrests get made. Him, as well as Radovan Karadzic, another person that's been called the Butcher of Bosnia. So it is an interesting position for the president of Serbia to be in. He has to tread somewhat lightly, but his country folk and neighboring Serbs in Bosnia, he also is trying to signal to them as well. But as you said, this is going to take a very long time to become reconciled, and if it ever will be.
Well, as I mentioned, high drama on the other side. Slobodan Paljak, the Bosnian general, the Bosnian Croat general, that had been sentenced already to 20 years, had appealed and was that decision was upheld. And he actually drank poison in the courtroom this week as he was listening to the judge. He spoke back to the judge saying that this was unjust, and he drank poison and was later declared dead. And so this was an amazing turn of events right there in front of everyone in the courtroom.
It seems like something from a film. He was part of six people that were up on appeal. As you said, Bosnian Croat, we often forget that there's this other side there. This is the final case, and we'll certainly have an investigation to find out what happened. Interestingly enough, he is the third person to commit suicide as part of the tribunal, so we'll definitely see there. But a very interesting and exciting week, also full of a great deal of emotion for those involved.
Well, as you mentioned, the ICTY is closing on the 31st of December, actually, after almost 25 years of work. 161 people indicted, 111 went to trial, I believe, and 90 convictions overall. So perhaps a subject for another discussion, Rebecca, but questions still remain about whether this is the kind of tool that we should use to look at war and war crimes, and also what this has to say about the end of impunity for such things. But we will carry that on in another conversation as we're out of time today. Thank you for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. Or you can like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at WorldviewsKGOU, and I'm at Suzette Gorlat. Next, I'll talk with Ambassador Arturo Sarocan about the relationship between Mexico and the United States. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Arturo Sarocan was Mexico's ambassador to the United States from 2007 to 2013, and he is currently an international strategic advisor in Washington, D.C. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Ambassador Arturo Sarocan, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you, Zette. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here, and would love to hopefully solve U.S.-Mexican relations today. I don't know if we can get that far, but let's at least talk about U.S.-Mexican relations. If we read the news, you would think we can't get along and that there are all kinds of problems with our relationship with the country that's, you know, right across the border and we share a lot with. Is that what we should think, or what's the real story here?
As in most good stories, it's a bit more complicated than that. And given that we're talking about stories, let me start with one of the best by Charles Dickens, A Tale of Two Cities. And in many ways, that's the story of this relationship, because it's the best of times and it's the worst of times. It's the best of times because both countries over the past two decades have really deepened their engagement, the impact that they have on each other's security, well-being, and prosperity. But at the same time, public perceptions and public narratives on both sides of the border have, especially in the last year and a half, become extremely challenging, in great part because of what has happened in the 2016 presidential campaign, where one of the contenders and now 45th president of the United States decided to use Mexico as a political piñata on three issues that in many ways intersect with concerns and worries and issues that truly impact the well-being and the livelihood of so many Americans. And if you come to think of it, the three issues with which he latched on to the Mexican agenda, trade and NAFTA, the issue of immigration and what that is doing or isn't doing to the fabric of American society, and then the issue of the border wall and security in a very convoluted and challenging and fluid world. These three issues are If you sort of boil them down to security, economic well-being, and cultural diversity and how the country is or isn't changing, these were hot-button issues throughout the campaign. So regardless of whether this had a passport called Mexico, these are issues that resonate with a big chunk of the American electorate. On top of this, I think that both countries, throughout successive governments, have done a relatively poor job of explaining to Americans and Mexicans alike why these two countries are uniquely important to one another. If you come to think about it, Suzette, on a daily basis, there's no country on the face of the earth that touches the well-being and the security of Americans on a daily basis like Mexico does. Yes, we have the North Koreas and the Middle Easts and the Chinas of the world, which are all important and salient geostrategic challenges to the national security of the United States. But on a day-to-day basis, no country touches the lives of American Americans as Mexico does, and vice versa. And I think one of the issues that many of us who believe in a mature, forward-looking, strategic, constructive relationship between these two neighbors, one of the things that we need to do is to understand how we win the hearts and minds of Mexicans and Americans. How do we explain to them what's at stake in productive relationships? And that despite that some people would like us to do that, you can't control, you can't press control, alt, delete, and erase either Mexico from one side of the border or the U.S. from the other side of the border. We're joined at the hip, and we have to understand how to tap into those opportunities, how to tackle some of the challenges that we face jointly, whether it's drugs moving in one direction and guns and bulk cash from the United States feeding organized crime moving in the other into Mexico.
Who carries the burden of this? Because the media clearly plays a role here, because you can't read positive stories, really, in the United States press, it seems to me. And I spend a lot of time in Mexico, and I travel there, and I am constantly dismayed at the negative news here. But it's really the case in Mexico, too, especially now. I mean, my most recent trip there, I can't believe how much negative commentary I got about what's happening here, because there's nothing but negative news about the United States in the Mexican press. So the media plays a role. Is it a failure of diplomats? I mean, you said the governments are not doing a very good job of making the case. So governments are failing, the media is failing, the people fail. You know, what
the private sector has done a terrible job. Again, regardless of what you think the impact of NAFTA has been, you're entitled to your own points of view, but you can't be entitled to your own data. And the data is very powerful and is very compelling. And regardless of what many Americans on the campaign trail heard throughout 2016, NAFTA directly sustains 5 million U.S. jobs. There are 26 states in America today that have Mexico as their number one trading partner. Mexico is the second largest buyer of U.S. goods after Canada. And the private sector sometimes, I think, has done a bad job in explaining to workers that X percentage of their paychecks comes because of trade with Mexico, or comes because we're building stuff together. When President Trump was talking about applying a 20% tariff on Mexican exports, whether it was to pay for the wall or to force Mexico to negotiate NAFTA, what he was missing, Suzette, is that the U.S. is no longer building U.S. products. Mexico isn't building Mexican products. And Canada isn't building Canadian products. Why? Because what has happened over the last decade is that our supply chains and production platforms have become unified. So out of every dollar of Mexican exports that come into the U.S., 40 cents, 0.40 cents of every dollar of Mexican exports are U.S. content. So we're producing North American goods because all our production chains are integrated. So you want to slap 20% tariffs on Mexican exports to the U.S., you're going to be slapping 20% tariffs on 40 cents of U.S. products that go into the manufacturing of these exports into the United States. So it's a much more complex scenario. The problem is that all this data doesn't fit in a bumper sticker when you're on a campaign. It's much easier to say NAFTA's the worst deal ever in the history of mankind. And it takes much more time, and it's a much more nuanced discussion to explain to people why, thanks to NAFTA, for example, the United States has been able to maintain its competitiveness vis-a-vis China. President Trump talks about the deficit with Mexico as a terrible thing. Yes, the United States does have a trade deficit with Mexico, but that trade deficit is equal to 8% of the total U.S. trade deficit with the world. So this is a red herring. The problem is, how do we put this data? How do we create a narrative? How do we create personal stories so people can understand why this relationship is so important? And how do we debunk some of the myths that are out there as to what either country is to the neighboring country? And that's a big challenge. And that's where I think academia and the media and governments and the private sector and the thousands of everything from Rotary clubs to Little League baseball teams to soccer leagues that every day cross the Mexican-U.S. border. It's the busiest border in the world. We've got 1 million legal crossings per day. We trade $1.4 billion with a B dollars a day of goods in both directions. It is a dynamic that you don't see on any other border on the face of the earth, regardless of the pressing challenges that we do have to ensure our security, to ensure that bad actors don't try to use the border to undermine the security and the well-being of either one of the two neighbors.
Let's talk about Mexico for a second, because we've got elections coming up soon. Mexico clearly does struggle with some security issues. We see, fragmentation of cartels and wars going on among them, and some of the political corruption that's happening. I mean, I don't want to leave the U.S. out of this mix, because there's stuff going on here too. But let's just talk about Mexico for a second, because that. Where are we headed in terms of Mexican domestic politics? Because that will hopefully affect the perception of Mexico.
There's no doubt in my mind that the Achilles heel of Mexico's perceptions in the U.S. has to do with Mexican domestic politics and the Mexican domestic content. And as long as Mexicans and successive Mexican governments are unable or unwilling to tackle the issues of impunity, endemic corruption, a weak rule of law, these narratives and perceptions about bad hombres or rapists or migrants who are coming here to steal jobs and to siphon away taxpayer dollars, those will continue to fester. In many ways, one of the best instruments that Mexico has to move the needle in terms of perceptions regarding the country here in the United States is to take on these formidable challenges that Mexico faces and has faced for many decades now. Not everything is black and white. There have been some important achievements, but the fact is that today Mexico still faces a critical challenge to underscore the rule of law and to root out corruption. This will be no surprise, one of the main drivers of the Mexican presidential campaign next July, when we go to the polls on July the 1st. It will be impunity and corruption and lack of rule of law and public insecurity. This is going to be one of the main issues, along with a meat and potato issue, which is the case for most electoral processes, which is the economy and jobs.
Along with this issue, the domestic political issues, the corruption, the rule of law, I was recently having a conversation with somebody along these lines about the fact that, well, how do you expect Mexican domestic politics to be any different or any better when they have like the world's worst neighbor next door because of the demand for the drug trade, right? So they've got a really bad neighbor in the extent that we're encouraging maybe a lot of the bad stuff that's happening in Mexico simply because we are the largest
consumer
of drugs in the world. What can we do about that? What's the U.S. government going to do about
that? It's undeniable that these issues are correlated, and that's why I've said when people ask me about Trump's wall, that first this is a first century BC solution to 21st century challenges. It's not going to solve the issue of how many drugs cross the border or not, and it has fundamentally grated Mexican public opinion as it relates to favorability perceptions of the United States. It is also true that a couple of decades ago, the United States would wag its finger at Mexico and say, most of the drugs coming into the United States come through Mexico. And Mexico would obviously, in a jingoistic and chauvinistic way, retort that if we were the springboard, you were the swimming pool. About just when I was starting my tenure as ambassador with President George W. Bush in 2007, there was a very striking shift in how Mexico and the United States started talking about issues like drug trafficking. Because both governments, and this was replicated later by the Obama administration, both governments understood that the only way that we were going to tackle things like transnational organized crime, whether it was drug trafficking or human smuggling, was through a paradigm of joint responsibility that both countries had to different degrees and with varying levels of engagement, a responsibility and a role to play in taking on these very tremendous challenges. Because, yes, I just said Mexico has a real structural problem with a weak rule of law and weak police and law enforcement institutions and impunity and corruption. But we get most of the firepower that the drug syndicates in Mexico use to push back against the state across the border from the United States. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out why you have more gun shops and gun shows along the U.S.-Mexico border than Walmarts, because you can't buy guns in Mexico. It's not legal. And therefore, these individuals take advantage of the loopholes that allow people in the United States to illegally buy illegal weapons and then cross them over the border into Mexico. So again, this is one example of how the only way we will find solutions to some of our common problems is by an approach based on joint responsibility.
Well, I hope we can recognize that. So thank you so much, Mr. Ambassador, for being here today and talking about this very important issue.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Arturo Sarocan. He was the Mexican ambassador to the United States from 2007 to 2013. He's currently a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Grelott.